Accession number 15448, reel 3.
Starkey Reel 3.
Thank you. So, one evening, my American friend, the man who'd been on, a Russian who'd been on an American ship, I think they called him Vladimir Slobodnikov, and he introduced me to a man, another Russian man who could speak a bit of English, and he said, I would like to play chess. He said, I'm a very poor player. Now, I'm used to that sort of thing. If you go into one of these pubs or coffee houses where they have played chess, and if a man sees you looking at him, he'll set the board up all wrongly, then he'll want to pay you for a pint, play for a pint of beer or something, and he'll set the board up all wrongly, so you'll take him on, and then he'll find he's quite a strong player. Well, anyway, I thought, well, yes, I did. So they arranged a room where we could sit quietly, and I played until about 2 a.m, and we played 3 games, and managed to win them all without being in any difficulty. I would rate him as about a man who played about 6 or 7 in a 10-board match in an intercity team. And I was hoping to play top board in Hull. So it was right that I should meet him. But he was very pleased that I had given him these games. And I thought no more about it, and they disappeared. But then next morning, this Vladimir came to me. Oh, he says, and he mentioned his name, I forget what it was in Russian, but he said, Starkey beat him 3 times out of 3, and he seemed to think that was a great achievement, you see. Well, I'm sure it was a very strong chess centre there. And there was a man in our ordinary ward where I was, he could play chess a bit, and I was playing him, and it was getting time for the lady doctor to come on her round, you see. I thought, well, I've usually beaten him fairly easily, I'd better get this game off, because I thought he'd just come into the ward and going round the bed, you see. And he got a very solid position. I thought, well, he's going to take some breaking down. And I hadn't succeeded in beating him, although I was getting the advantage. And then this lady comes right up to the next bed. I thought, well, I hope she's patient with me. But she didn't seem to mind us playing on, and she was talking with the patient in the bed. And he kept saying, talking, I thought, well, that's all right if she's happy talking there. And I found a good way of attacking him. And then he found a good reply that stitched me up there that I couldn't make any progress. So I thought, well, I can probably attack on the king side if I advance my pawn. It'll leave my king a bit exposed, but I should be able to deal with it. But there again, he started playing really well. I thought, well, isn't that funny? Just when I went to get it over, this chap is playing real well. And then I was watching him, and then a remark she made there, he reacted to it. I realised then that this lady doctor was telling him the move, and I found she had a good high grade in chess, you see. And in the end, I was only able to draw that game because she was telling him the moves. I tried to arrange the game with her. I did eventually one night, and we played for about a couple of hours or so, and it was a dead drawn position. I couldn't make any progress, and then the air and sirens went, so we really broke it off. I really enjoyed that time with the Russian chess players. It was nice to have friends, because there was nobody at first could speak English. It was very good. And then after a time, I was discharged from that hospital, and with the arrangement, I was going into the sort of sick bay place in HMS Edinburgh. And we were going to join up with a merchant convoy. I was disappointed about this. I was looking forward to going to Edinburgh, where I'd travel about 30 knots and really steady. I knew what would happen once I got into a 10-knot convoy. The rule of life held, you know. If you're in bed, you're putting your feet on the bulkhead, you know, like the wall, and it was rolling like the 10 knots. And then one of the officers, medical officers, they seemed a bit bit cheesed off with me. Apparently, I should have reported to him to have my left arm examined. And it was plaster from finger right up to shoulder. And yeah, I didn't fancy Royal Navy. I was wrong about this. I didn't fancy Royal Navy attention. I thought it'd be all right to have it properly set when I got back to Hull. I was very wrong about this. Because apparently, if a bone or anything is out of joint, if you don't have it set within a few hours, bone grows up into the joint and it never works properly. So anyway, he got me into their little service room, medical room, and took the plaster off, and I was like this, you see. They said, right, well, straighten your arm. And I kept saying, reach down, but I couldn't reach down, you see. He says, what's the matter, Starkey? Can't you straighten it? No, can't straighten it. And then, I just thought, I hope it's going to be all right. And then a call came on, you know, the bosun's whistle came. All hands to action stations. Oh, so I said, oh, well, we're going to be engaged now. Probably we'll have to plaster it temporarily. And they abandoned the idea of giving me the operation. They were going to reset the head of the radius. They realised that it wasn't in, you see. So that was abandoned because of action station. And it was just some aircraft, but they had powerful anti-aircraft on the, they had the high angle and the pom-poms and the fast stuff and the sheared off, so it wasn't very much to go action stations for. And then we finally met up with the convoy, and we were doing, I say, just a meager 10 knots. And I don't think I was ever seasick at sea, but I sort of felt really groggy about this. Rolling so much. You see, there's all the heavy hardware, the big guns, the six big guns, fore and aft, and a terrific lot of rolling, you see, and then just putting up with it. And then suddenly they put on speed and they sped out of the convoy, out of the depth charge screen, you know, going around these convoys, there's corvettes, destroyers, what have you. Kept dropping depth charges, you see, to keep U-boats away. And I went outside the depth charge screen, and I found out later from one of the racing that every now and then these rogue destroyers came out, nipping out from the Norwegian coast or the Finnish coast, this was, and having a crack at these convoys and disappearing, you see. And so apparently he thought we'd gone out to chase away one of these high-speed destroyers. But after we'd been out of the convoy screen for about a quarter of an hour or so, there were two terrific crashes, and we were hit by two torpedoes on the port side. Now, the one that struck amidships actually caused might have been two ratings to drown in their own fuel oil, and there were several other casualties, so there was chaos going on down there. They managed to get the lights on, but the second crash was the first torpedo hit amidships, the second one hit right near the stern, and that was the one that was really lethal, that killed off the Edinburgh in a way, because when we tried to move away from this danger area back to the convoy, we could only go around in circles. We're a sitting duck, only able to go in circles. We couldn't see it at the time, but I found out that this torpedo that had struck near the stern had bent out a huge sheet of metal, which outweighed, at such an angle, it outweighed all influence of the rudder. And so we're just as though we're set with the helm right over, and we could only go round in circles. Onto this huge sheet of metal at this angle. We quickly flooded watertight compartments on the starboard side to match where there were flooded compartments from the torpedoes. And they got the Edinburgh on even keel again. But it wasn't much good if they couldn't go anywhere. And also, in sealing up these starboard side airtight, watertight compartments, we had we'd caused some rigging to be trapped below the waterline. They couldn't get up because it was all locked. And so they were in an awful predicament. That meant they would be trapped down there until their air gave out, you see. So they, I suppose that they'd been in communication with other ships, and they got a steel tow rope. They were going to try to tow us back to Murmansk. But of course, having been torpedoed twice, there was a lot of extra water down below, and it was partly waterlogged, and it would need a hell of a lot of towing. And I watched this tow rope become very, very tight. And then I thought, well, it's not very good, this. So I moved down below to an apartment, a good job I did, because within a minute or two, there was a terrific crash, and there was a whiplash of this steel tow rope across the ship. It could have killed anybody in the way, and it broke. And we thought, well, that's hard luck for those trapped. Anyway, about an hour or two later, they got another tow rope going. But the same thing happened, it snapped again. So I thought, well, this is going to be the end of it, Edinburgh. We're going to go down in this area here. We can't get away. They can't tow us. And then it was also very, very cold because the torpedoes had damaged the electric heating system, and they had these fires, but normally electric fires were normally quite good, only just a mere glow and those people sitting round them. And I felt the wind was very, very cold on this, on the old pot, on the plaster, you see. So I went down below a bit, and then I thought I'd better go and see what's going. And I went up, there's a great fuss on deck. They'd seen, coming slowly towards us, a third torpedo. And that's the scene here, it's coming so slowly. They put all the machine guns, small arms stuff, everything, to try and either sink it or explode it. Once or twice we did explode torpedoes in other ships, but this one, we couldn't deflect them at all. He couldn't do anything. He eventually came just so slowly up to us and hit hell of a crash, and that meant that we were sinking further below what we should have been. We were well below our normal position in the water. And I thought, well, then what's going to happen now? We'll probably have to abandon. But nothing seemed to be happening. And then a message did come round, all hands on deck. I thought, that's it, they're going to abandon. But I was so cold up there, and it seemed to be hours and nothing was happening. So I thought, well, I'll go below and get a bit of shelter, and I must have sort of dozed off up there. It's a silly thing to do, but I was so cold. Then after a time, I woke up and I thought, well, I'd better see what's happening. And I went on deck, and there alongside was the the fleet minesweeper Harrier. We'd gone to the Edinburgh and the Gossamer, but this was the Harrier, and there was rope netting around it. And there's very few people on the ship, and a naval waiter comes up to me and says, where the hell have you come from? Oh, I told him I'd been down low. He says, climb up that netting up there. It didn't seem to know under my duffel coat I got this arm in plaster. I managed to get so far up, and then as I was trying to get under the next one, an American fella got hold of my hand. And I thought, well, I can't stay like this. And then he says, oh, I can't hold this position very long. And then two powerful American just grabbed hold of me, put my head over his on the ship. So I was rescued again. And on this Harrier, we were set sail back from Murmansk, and they kept dropping depth charges. They had to have a good run of speed and drop it off. And you could feel almost like a smack under your feet as the depth charges went off. But we finally did get back to Murmansk.
Was this HMS Harrier?
Oh yes, it was our end ship, yeah. When I got back to Murmansk, I was put into the... no need to go back to hospital. I was put into the Hotel Arctica, a big, what they call in tourist hotel. Quite nice there, but I found it quite cold. And when the sort of chambermaids came to my room, they said, they thought I looked cold. They said, hold in there. I said, duh. So I think they got me an extra blanket. I was able to go into the social part of the hotel. I had an odd game of chess with the Russians. It wasn't too bad, but it was not a very high standard. And then an RN fella comes up to me one day, says, "Now, Sparks," he said, "if you can forget you're an officer, we've absolutely no accommodation for officers. If you can forget you're an officer, you can go on the tribal class destroyer Somali, and we're going to escort the crew of the Trinidad that have been damaged, helping us on the way out, you see. And we're going to run the gauntlet through Bomb Alley at 40 knots. I thought, well, this is great. Oh, yes, I said, I'm no officer. Right, so the next day, I went into a big truck. We didn't go up the sea, up the river. And there was about 30, 40 people in this big truck. And it took us round to the naval base. And there was HMS Somali, the tribal class destroyer. And there was the Trinidad a bit further up. And then there were three other destroyers. Apparently the four destroyers were going to sail with the Trinidad in the middle and go through Bomb Alley at a hell of a speed. The other destroyers... We'd got the Somali ourselves. There was the Machilus, which was a lightning class. The Forester and the Foresight. The Forester had a terrible time with us on the way out. They got a shell through the engine room and superheated steam had escaped. And the young fellows who dashed up the companionway, they were burnt to death in no time by superheated steam. The old hands who staled down got the feet scalded, but they survived. And the Forester was patched up. But it was able to do the 40 knots. And as soon as we got clear, we naturally wouldn't do 40 knots in the Kola River, only about 10 knots. But once we got out into the open sea and heading west for Scotland, we really opened out to full speed. But the following day on the distance, we noticed an aircraft, which must have been an enemy. Some said it was a Fokker Wolf, I don't know what it was, but a reconnaissance thing, right on the horizon, going round, you see. We knew we would be reporting our position, and we'd soon have a big air raid over us. Now, we fired. They thought they'd have a go with the high angle, the biggest type of high angle, put a shell. It seemed to me that it was hellish near, but it didn't affect him. It must have given him a scare, because it went a bit further off, more or less out of sight, but it was still there. And they were no doubt reporting in Morse code that there were four destroyers and a cruiser, which was quite a useful target for them, you see. And we'd made quite a few miles. It must have been about half an hour. And then the sign went up, "All hands to action stations." And I couldn't see anything that caused it, because those observers were very, very good. And what the hell are they going to action stations for? But then they were all ready to fire. And then all these bombers did come over us, a hell of a lot. And there was hell let loose. And they were firing everything at them. But I noticed mostly they were firing defensively, and they put a barrier in front, especially the Trinidad, in front of them for them to fly into, instead of actually just firing at them. Now, that was my opinion. I could be wrong about that, but I know these things did happen. And we had sort of a college boy type of captain. And you can hear him giving the command, more slowly, full ahead, harder starboard. It never dropped an H or anything. And we were dodging sticks and bombs almost, you know, as you're going full ahead. And then harder starboard. You know, you don't go around like that. You go around the reverse way, you know. And I hadn't been used to these manoeuvres, and I thought, well, this is wonderful. And but I realised, well, if this has happened to us, what about the Trinidad? Because obviously the Trinidad was the main target. But he kept dodging sticks and bombs. I thought, it was marvellous. The manoeuvrability of this triboclass destroyer, I couldn't believe it. The way that they put on a stern and almost stopped and then spurted on to these stops. And but after, it would be about 10 minutes of this, I suddenly noticed that there were flames coming out of the Trinidad. The Trinidad had been hit towards the stern end, and it was blazing. And there was smoke as well coming. I thought, oh, let's hope that doesn't explode. And she still kept firing from the forward end, but I realised that she was crippled. And we fired for a few more minutes, and they seemed to think, well, they can't sink the destroyer. The enemy disappeared. So while it was still blazing fiercely, the four destroyers in turn went alongside the Trinidad to take off their share of survivors. Fortunately, it didn't explode while we were doing it. And then I wonder what they're going to do with the Trinidad. And I thought, well, are they going to let it sink? But anyway, eventually, wasn't I? Was one of the destroyers, I think it was the Matchless, went and fired a couple of torpedoes in it. I didn't want anything, especially secret material, to fall into enemy hands, you see. And as happens, you know, after a time, they go right up vertical, stern upwards, and then slowly sink down. It's quite sad watching that go.
So you were saying how sad it was to see the end of the...
Yeah, it was very sad, and then we sailed on our way to... I thought they were going to Scapa Flow, the naval base, but anyway, they're going to Scotland, by the course it said. And then it seemed to be all calm and peaceful, and then suddenly... I was looking out and I couldn't see anything untoward. I went, all hands to action station. And the director got the helmets and, you know, just as though they're going to be blown out of the water with their action station. They're ever so quick, it's something like about 20 seconds and everybody was at action station. I thought, no, I went up. Why the hell have they gone to action station? But of course, the lookout on the top had wonderful eyes. And after a time, I saw, right almost through the semi-mist, little light flashing moss. And I thought, oh, well, that's it then. And I thought, well, the enemy wouldn't flash in moss. And then this moss was a recognition signal, and straight away, third degree, that was the next alert to action station. So they went back to third degree, came out of action station. But apparently they always did that. When they saw another ship, before they knew whether it was one of ours or not, they always went to action station in case... They started firing straight away. And then what happened, it was the Nigeria, one of the big, was it 8-inch gun crews, one of the big crews, Nigeria. I don't know the ship, I think there were two more destroyers, and I can't think who they were, but they joined us. And by now we're over the coast of Norway, so you're getting well towards Scotland. And I thought, oh, it should be all right now. How wrong I was. The fact that the other capital ship had joined us, you see, that made another very big target. And they went to action stations again. And we didn't have to wait very long this time. And those loads of aircraft came on and all hell was let loose. And this was actually the worst air raid that I'd ever hit. Witnessed or experienced. Everything seemed to be drifting from us, and yet the Nigeria was magnificent, put up a tremendous barrier to keep the aircraft from getting at us, and you know, a defensive barrier. And I'm sure that one ship ventured too near, and it was one aircraft was shot down. But it was quite a long way from us. I saw the aircraft fall in the sea. I don't know what it was or anything, but this raid was lasting for a long time, and then they didn't want to exhaust the main magazine amidships, so they called for volunteers to carry, this is on the Somali, to carry live shells from the foreign magazine to the amidships magazine, you see. So I volunteered and we're in a chain gang passing these along, you see. And of course, the sea ones all that calm. And a rate had come to me and said, "Hey, you can't carry live shells with one arm." So I was taken out of it. So I thought, well, I'm going to be, I hated being a passenger on a ship. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to be a passenger after all. I couldn't help in any way. And then, well, the air raid was continuing. After a time, I noticed that what we were firing was different, and I found out and inquired it was, so that we were getting so low in ammunition, and then we started firing black sand practice shells, just sort of psychological warfare. Because you never had to run out of ammunition in any engagement, you see. So they were serving this back and just firing black sand practice shells. But the Nigeria was very active, and after, well, it was quite a long while. It lasted, I couldn't say, something like half an hour or more. But eventually it was broken off. And apparently we hadn't lost any ships. I think that was partly due to Nigeria, because it really did more or less protect everybody as well as herself. So, well, thank God the Nigeria had come off, although it probably caused the air raid by being there. And then all seemed lovely, and we're on a lovely sunny week. We got round to the far side of Scotland, down the west coast, and we got into the Clyde. Thought, well, that's wonderful, mission accomplished.
What happened with your arm then, once you got back to Hull?
Yes, I'm going to tell you that. Is it on?
Yes.
Yes, well, I went to the Hull Royal Infirmary, knowing it needed some attention, you see. And I didn't have to make an appointment with being a war casualty. They saw me straight away, but they said, well, we'll take the x-rays, and in 2 days' time it'll be, actually on the Thursday, I think it'll be, Mr. Tatum, who was the orthopaedic specialist, he'll be around and have a look at it, you see. So they took the plaster off and x-rayed my arm. And then they noticed I couldn't straighten the arm, and they thought that was very odd, but they put a temporary plaster on until Mr. Tatum could see it, you see. But I got a letter, I think the very next day, saying that would I come and be re-x-rayed, because they didn't like the angle of the radius. That's the small bone, you know. So apparently they only x-rayed the ulna, thinking that was the main trouble. And then it showed, just showed in the x-ray, you see the ulna, and then it just leaning off at an angle was the radius, and then that was the end of the picture. So they took a picture of the elbow itself, and they found out that it was, so that the head of the radius was dislocated. And then when I saw the specialist about this, he said, well, he found out